The question is as to why it is that in John's Gospel, Jesus has resolutely set himself to go to the cross, but when you look at the Garden of Gethsemane in the Synoptic Gospels, it appears that Jesus is seeking to avoid the cross. Good question. Let's take a look at John chapter 12 for a starting point. This is prior to the night that Jesus was in Gethsemane, but it's a very interesting thing to note what Jesus says. If you look at John chapter 12, verse 27, "Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say?" And so what is here within that follows is intended as a question. So the idea is, shall I say, "Father, deliver me from this hour"? He rejects that notion and says, "But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Now it would be very strange if Jesus were actually in the Garden of Gethsemane backing away from this confident assertion that he has made. Besides that, in the Gospel of John, we find in John chapter 2 that when he has cleansed the temple and Judeans say to him, "What sign do you do since you do these things? Give us the evidence that you have the right to cleanse the temple." His answer was, "Destroy this sanctuary, and in 3 days I will raise it up again." We also find that he has made in the Synoptic Gospels after that predictions of his upcoming crucifixion, resurrection. But let's take a close look at Matthew's account of Gethsemane. There's going to be a surprise for some of us. So let's look at Matthew chapter 26.
So before you go there, John, on 12:28, yes. "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." Are you going to address that? Or?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I want to know.
No.
"I have glorified it."
Yes.
Meaning the Son came.
Yes.
"And I will glorify it again when he dies and resurrects."
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I thought, but I just wanted to make sure. I want to confirm.
Is that, has any relationship with John 1:14?
Of him tabernacle? Let's see.
You know, is it 1:18, where it says, "No one has seen the Father"?
Right. But he has explained him, or?
Yeah, he's him and known.
So yes.
Yeah, okay.
In John chapter 14, when the disciples asked, or when Philip asked, "Just show us the Father," he said, "Have I been with you so long, and you haven't figured out that when you see me, you are seeing the Father?" Not that he's the visible manifestation of the Father, but he perfectly carries out what the Father has sent him to say and to do, in keeping with Deuteronomy chapter 18. And so he's saying, if you have contact with me, you've had contact with the Father through me. Okay, Matthew chapter 26. Okay, the Gethsemane prayers occur in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matthew's account is the most detailed. What we find out in Matthew is that there were three separate times that Jesus prayed in the garden. Matthew records what Jesus said on two of the occasions, and the third time he says that he prayed the same thing. So I'd like to just read the passage, then we'll look at an analysis of it. Matthew chapter 26, starting at verse 36. Then Jesus came with them, that is with the 11, to a place called Gethsemane. Gethsemane means olive oil press. And said, and there are olive trees to this day there. They are not, they don't date back to the year 70, but they are extremely old.
Judas is not there, John?
He's not there.
Oh, yes, actually, yes, he is. Judas is there. I'm sorry, I said 11 and I should have said 12. Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, "Sit here while I go and pray over there." And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, that would be James and John, and began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me." He went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, "O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." First glance, and what almost everybody thinks out of this verse, is that he is trying to escape the cross. Let's look at it again. "O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." We'll skip on without further comment. This is the first of his prayers. Verse 40. Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, "What? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Verse 42. Again a second time he went away and prayed, saying, "O my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me, unless I drink it, your will be done." That's second prayer. Verse 43. And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. So he left them, went away again, and prayed a third time, saying the same words. Then he came to his disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." Universally, this is taught from the standpoint of Jesus trying to escape the cross. But let's look very, very closely at verse 42. Verse 42 will not allow that conclusion. And once you see how verse 42 should be approached, it resolves the issue here. It also resolves the issue in Mark's account and in Luke's account. So, let's look at verse 42. "If this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done." Okay, everyone recognizes that he's saying, "Father, I'm going to do your will, even if it's not what I want to do." But now the question becomes, what is he praying? Is he praying to escape the cross? He can't be. Because he says, "The cup can't pass until I drink it." The cup represents the cross. What's he saying?
He doesn't want to be separated from the Father.
But he's going to be crucified. What he's saying is, let's do this as quickly as possible. He's saying, don't drag this out. The timetable when he would be allowed to go to the cross has been met. Palm Monday, 4 days earlier, according to the chronology of the prophecy in Daniel chapter 9 that we will get to in several weeks, as of Palm Monday, he could be crucified. The 69 heptads of that prophecy came to a conclusion on Palm Monday in the year 33 AD. What he's saying is, let me drink it. Let me get it over with. But if it needs to stretch out longer, I'm willing to follow your will. Let's look a little more closely at the first prayer. Okay, does what I'm saying make sense? That he's not praying, let me escape the cross. What he's praying is, let me go to the cross as quickly as possible so that this cup will have passed. Let it pass by me going there. So now let's look at the first prayer in Matthew 26:39. Oh, my Father, if it is possible, the way that this is phrased in Greek is what is called a first-class condition, which means, and I'm assuming that it can pass from me. If it can, if it is possible, and I'm assuming that it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Let me go to the cross. Let's not stretch this out any longer than we need to. But if you need to stretch it out longer, I'm willing to wait. Now let's go to Mark chapter 14. We'll see the parallel.
John?
Yes.
All through John, he kept saying, my time has not come. My time has not come.
Absolutely.
My time has not come. Over and over again, then all of a sudden, so it's like what you're saying, all of a sudden, the Father is saying, okay, your time has come. But if the Father decided, okay, we need a little more time, he would have said, my time has not come.
Right. Well, once we hit John chapter 12, John chapter 12 is when the prophecy of Daniel reached its conclusion. Then Jesus switched to saying, the hour has come. He said it twice in the Gospel of John after Palm Monday. Mark chapter 14, verse 36. And he said, Abba, and Abba just means Father in Aramaic, all things are possible for you. Is he saying here, a lot of things are possible? No, he says, all things are possible. Take this cup away from me. Now, is he saying, take it away before I go to the cross? Don't let me go there. Or is he saying, take it away by letting me go? Once again, he says, nevertheless, not what I will, but you will. I'm willing to go with your timetable, but I'm letting you know that my request is, let's not delay this any longer than it has to be delayed. Now let's go to Luke chapter 22, which is the other parallel. Luke 22, verse 42. Mark and Luke each only include one of the times that Jesus prayed. Father, if it is your will, again, first class condition, if it is your will, and I'm assuming it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. So, my argument is that Jesus is indicating that he would like it removed as soon as possible by letting him face the cross as soon as possible, but that he is willing to work with any timetable that the Father needs.
And John, I think Matthew 16:21 solidifies your
sure.
point.
What was that?
Matthew 16:21.
Yes, as I said, what we have in the Synoptic Gospels is three predictions of his, the things that start with the cross and so forth. From that time, Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. He is the greater than Moses prophet like Moses. If anything that he says doesn't happen, he proves himself not to be the greater than Moses prophet like Moses that was predicted in Deuteronomy 18. So this has to come true. He's predicted this. It has to come. And so there's one other internal argument that I think is very interesting. Let's go back to Matthew 26. How many times have you heard people say, do as I say, not as I do? Well, if we were to hold to the traditional interpretation of Jesus' prayers in Gethsemane, Jesus would be saying to his disciples, do as I say, not as I do. That is, do as I tell you, not as I communicate my thoughts to the Father. Look at it. He says, in verse 40, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, what? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. He's saying, you guys need to pray so you don't go flaking off and go to sleep when you're supposed to be praying. But I can say, I want to play hooky on this. I don't want to go to the cross. Father, let me escape the cross. Even though he knows it's the Father's will. That makes his exhortation, it would be hollow. But instead what he's saying is, whether or not the timetable is the one that I want, I'm going to do exactly what the Father wants. So he says, disciples, you need to pray the same thing about yourselves. I think the traditional interpretation has given us a lot of unnecessary problems in this passage. Let's see, I have written on this, and so it's in A Grace in Focus, but I don't know the date of that.
What is the title? You
know, I think it was Take This Cup.
Okay.
John, Mark 14:34, Jesus speaks, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. And to me, that sets up that I know what's going to happen. This cup will not be taken from me. I get it. Is that correct or not?
Right, that's absolutely correct. Now there's... I've had my thinking changed on these passages a bit since the time that I wrote the article that my wife is looking up. The question becomes, what happens to the cup once it's taken away? And I used to think, okay, well, it just disappears. But I don't think so. Let's look at Mark chapter 10.
Verse
In Mark chapter 10, we have the sons of Zebedee asking for special privilege and rewardability. Starting at 10:35, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him, saying, "Teacher, we want for you to do for us whatever we ask." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Grant us that we may sit, one on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory." But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink?" And we know what the cup is referring to. "And to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with." And the baptism is also referring to the cross. Or more generally, in the case of the disciples, to their suffering with him in standing up for him in ministry, facing persecution, facing martyrdom, facing all this. They said to him, "We are able." So Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism I am baptized with, you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared." He's saying that has to wait until the Bema, till the judgment seat of Christ, and those who are evaluated that come out of the evaluation being well done, good and faithful servant, they're going to have special privilege. I can't preempt that. It has to wait until then. I'm going to let Steve, though, speak on Mark 16, because there the issue is, what baptism is he talking about there?
Just one other point real quick on the math. We have all kinds of in Matthew 20:17, before we look at 16:21, sure. And Jesus said, "I'm going to Jerusalem, where I'm going to be betrayed, where I'm going to be killed, and 3 days later I'm going to resurrect." Now if you look at 18, he says, this time, "Behold, not I, but we." So the disciples are going to go with him. Everything else is exactly the same, except he doesn't say killed here. He said crucified.
Yep.
So he's got to go. You couldn't say, well, he's saying, well, kill me a different way. No, he's saying here, he's going to the cross. You see that? So if he's told his disciples, they're going with him, we're going to the cross. And then he goes, April Fools, we're not doing that. I asked the Father, and he said, I don't have to do that. Then the whole thing's a fraud.
Yep.
Okay. Mark 16. So if where it gets interesting. Is in verse 15, Jesus says to them, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He who believes and is baptized will be saved, but he who does not believe will be condemned or judged." So the question here is, believes in what? Baptized into what? Saved from what? And judged from what? Okay, so what would you say the first one is? Believes in what?
Resurrection.
Good. Resurrection. Most people look at this and believes in Jesus for eternal life is what they would say. But if you look back up at verse at the beginning of the chapter, they didn't believe Jesus had resurrected. And so he condemns them for not believing in his resurrection. And then the second one is baptized into what? So that's the next question.
Suffering.
You can look back in Mark chapter 1, and they talk about John baptizing. So you have that baptism. But then in maybe 10, chapter 10 somewhere, 10 or 11, there's a baptism into suffering. Maybe 10. It was just what you 10, what you just said. So baptism into suffering. So you have to ask yourself, baptized into what? Okay, this isn't dunking baptism. This isn't baptism of the Holy Spirit. This is baptized into suffering. Right? And then, saved from what? So who's the audience he's talking to here?
Disciples.
How many?
11.
11. Judas is already gone. He's already killed himself. He's talking to the 11 disciples. 10 disciples. That's right. 10 disciples. He's talking to the 10 disciples. And he's going to save them from what? They're already believed. He's already gone and built a house for them. He's already promised he's going to come back and get them. What's he going to save them from? They're going to be able to pick up serpents. They're going to be able to drink deadly poisons. People are going to try to hurt them. They're going to lay hands on the sick, and the people will recover. He's going to miraculously deliver them from all these things so they can get the message out. But he who does not believe in what?
Resurrection.
The resurrection will be judged. What could that judgment be? They may die physically. But it's not going to go to the lake of fire. So all those catchwords that we see all the time have different meaning. And if you give a test, normally people get less than 50%. Many get 0 out of the 4.
Now, I said that this caused, after I wrote the article on the Gethsemane prayers, I had a change in my approach to it a little bit, in that I thought that the cup disappeared as, okay, once Jesus goes to the cross, okay, that's over and done with, so the cup has passed from him. But Jesus had instituted also in the night that he was betrayed the Lord's table. I believe that they shared a common cup. And one of the parts of the symbolism was he's passing the cup on to them. That he suffered in ministry, and they would suffer in ministry to people concerning Christ. So it's not that the cup disappears. The cup gets passed.
Like a baton.
Yes. So that was a change from the time I wrote the article. Did you find it?
What I found was Grace and Focus.
Yes.
March and April 2016. It was the magazine article.
I'll give you a website for those of you who don't know it. It's faithalone.org. So faith alone is one word, .org. Then you'll see publications or something like that. Click that. Then it will say Grace in Focus, which is their free newsletter. And the date you want is March, April of 2016. And so I've gone into more detail on this. But at the time that I wrote that article, I had not yet come to the conclusion that the cup gets passed. So I titled it, Take This Cup Away. If I were rewriting the article, it would be, Let This Cup Pass From Me. Because that's the wording that's used in several of the passages where the prayer is recorded.
He passed the cup to the right, correct?
That's with the way that they were positioned for the Passover, that would be very logical.
So was it Thomas that received it first?
Well, I believe that John was immediately behind him. Judas was immediately in front. But, so it would have been John.
According to the picture, they're all on the same side of the table.
Yeah, okay. Passover was, let's see, it's an unfortunate thing, but when you're reading in your English Bible, the word sit is used in places where they weren't sitting. That there are a couple of terms that are used for reclining. One of the questions that's asked at a Passover Seder is, why is it on this night that we recline instead of sitting? And the answer has to do with that those with privilege and money would recline as they ate. And so with the Passover, God had promised that the Egyptians would bestow all sorts of things in order to, okay, leave us because we're facing all sorts of consequences. And so at the Passover, they are to act as though they are wealthy people, and they recline. And so it's a different posture. And so in John chapter 2, we have the person, remember, that tastes the wine and says, why is it that you serve the inferior wine and then serve the better wine? He's called a master of ceremonies or various other terms. It's interesting what the Greek says. He's the master of the triclinium. They say, what is that? The tables would be very low, and then people were reclining, and as they recline, they're propped on one elbow, and they use the other hand for eating with. Makes a very simple posture for Mary to anoint Jesus' feet, because he's in a reclining position. He's not seated, so she's not climbing under the table. That his feet are facing away from the table. But for a meal that people would recline, the tables and the couches were arranged in such a way as to make it easy for the servers to put all the food there. And so the center area is open, and people are facing away from it. Next time I'll bring a, Diane, mark a note for me to bring a picture of a triclinium. And so there would be three couches. We have the word recliner. So a triclinium is where people are reclining away in three different directions. So it's shaped essentially like a T, but with a center area that the servers were able to go in between. So fancy meals, in the Bible, it will often say that people were reclining rather than sitting. Once you know that that's the case, then you're looking at a very special meal. And so there are places in the text, including in John chapter 12, the meal that served honoring Jesus and Lazarus that Jesus had just raised, that they were reclining rather than sitting. Yes?
This is kind of a weird question. Do you think Jesus experienced human pain, or did he have the pain of our sins? Was his pain justified because of what he was doing? Or was it just a human pain?
I would suspect that he had, the way that it's portrayed in Hebrews, it was for the joy that was set before him that he endured the pain and faced all of that. I think that the gravity of the whole situation was beyond just the physical pain. Now, I do not take the reference to my God, why have you forsaken me in the traditional way, as I've explained that in ancient times they did not have chapter and verse references. If I say a couple of words, you'll be able to identify who said it and the occasion. Ask not. So you think John F. Kennedy, his inaugural address. I have a dream. There again, you're able to identify a whole context from a small number of words. Pardon?
On a 3-hour tour.
I don't know.
Just
going to
say
different
names.
Killing it. Yep. Okay.
You have to add that in there, see if anybody knows that
one. Yeah, sure. So, since they did not have chapter numbering, they did not have verse numbering, the common way of helping people figure out an entire context would be to cite a well-known verse within a passage. And so, if I say, in the beginning, we're thinking either John 1 or we're thinking Genesis 1. We can make certain statements, and it causes us to think entire passage. When the psalmist in Psalm 22 says, my God, why have you forsaken me? What he says, well, let's turn to Psalm 22. Let's look at it. It's important to know about the heading of this psalm. It's not part of our English Bible's numbering, but what it says above verse 1, to the chief musician, set to the deer of the dawn, a psalm of David, is part of the text in Hebrew. Now, you might wonder, what does to the deer of the dawn have to do with anything? It's actually a major key to the entire psalm. It seems to be the title of the music to which this would be played. Now, if you are looking at a sunrise in a mountainous situation, it seems as though the sun is ready to go above the mountain. It seems bright. It seems like it's ready to come over, but it doesn't. It delays, and it delays, and it delays. And there's a simple reason, a physics reason, and that is we have layers of air that form like this, with different temperature gradients. My fellow geographer is smiling. But what happens is, as we look to the east with a sunrise, if there are mountains east of us, we are actually seeing through the curvature of the layers of air. And so what happens is, it's as if we have a way to look over. We see the sun, we see the brightness, but it takes so long for the sun to actually clear the horizon to where it moves into sunrise. And then what happens is it looks like it leaps. And the deer of the dawn is describing that phenomena. That it seems like it is taking forever for the deliverance of daytime to come, for the sun to actually clear the horizon. It's, you can see that there's light up there, and you're saying, it looks like it ought to be just right now. When we were in Israel, on the Dead Sea, one morning I was just shooting picture after picture after picture of this in order to get a picture right as the sun came, but to have a series of pictures that were before it. This psalm, I can imagine the music. It starts out dreary, hopeless, and then all of a sudden, the sun leaps. The deer leaps over the horizon. And so it starts out very dreary. Verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me and from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry in the daytime, but you do not hear, and in the night season, and I am not silent. Notice the change in standpoint in verse 3. But you are holy, enthroned in the praises of Israel. What does that mean? He's saying, Israel praises you because you always deliver Israel. But you're not delivering me. I'm just having to wait here. Our fathers trusted in you. They trusted and you delivered them. But I'm just here waiting. It's taking forever. They cried to you and were delivered. They trusted in you and were not ashamed. He's contrasting how Israel has always received deliverance, and it just seems to be dragging on and on and on, and he's not receiving deliverance. Then he quotes the people who are standing around mocking him. But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men, despised by the people. All those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head, saying, he trusted in the Lord. Let him rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Switch in standpoint again. But you are he who took me out of the womb. You made me trust while on my mother's breast. Not only Israel has always received deliverance from you, I've always received deliverance from you until now. I was cast upon you from birth, from my mother's womb. You have been my God. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. And then there's a description of the crucifixion. But then I'd like for us to look at verse 21b. You have answered me. This is where the dawn has occurred. This is where it becomes bright. This is where it changes. I will declare your name to my brethren. In the midst of the assembly, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, glorify him. So the music is entirely appropriate to this. When he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you just letting me hang here? I've always been able to count on you. Israel's always been able to count on you. But then when the deliverance comes, and the way the deliverance comes is through the resurrection, after he's been buried, he is speaking about the millennial wedding feast in triumphant tones. This passage is quoted both in Matthew, or verse 1 is quoted in Matthew and in Mark. I do not see it as Jesus saying, all hope is lost. I see it instead as, when someone says, ask not. They're not talking about that phrase. They're talking about the whole speech. And what he's saying is, I know where this is going. The people who are around me don't. The people who are around me who are mocking, they don't know your deliverance. They don't know that I am going to be resurrected. I believe that Jesus was in great physical agony. He was also in great agony over the fact that he was facing sin of all of humanity, past, present, and future. But he knew that his deliverance was around the corner. And this is not a cry of despair, but it's this temporary, terrible situation is going to be replaced by the greatest deliverance that has ever happened on planet Earth.
It's feeling this little anguish.
Absolutely. Hurt,
because it wasn't like that, but knowing the end result.
Mm-hmm. So yes, the pain, the anguish, all of that's there, but he's saying, I'm referring to the whole passage. There are no other verses in this that are as famous as that first verse. Now, it's also something interesting. You might wonder, why didn't the people around him know what he was saying? Remember how they said, he's calling for Elijah. There's something very interesting about it. This, when you hear it in the Gospels, in Matthew and Mark, it says, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. That is not Hebrew. It's Aramaic. The Aramaic would be, Eli, Eli, lama azabtani. And so, with it being an entirely different word for forsaken, people weren't picking it up. On top of that, his voice would be very strained under being ripped apart the way that happened in crucifixion. So I mean, his voice would not have been an easy to understand voice, but on top of that, he's not even quoting the passage in Hebrew. He's rendering it in Aramaic.
Saying that, wasn't the, my God, wasn't it Abba Father, Abba Father?
Well, he would just say Abba. Abba means Father. Yeah. It literally means the Father, but in both Hebrew and Aramaic, when they wanted to address someone, you would say, if you were going to say, King, would you do this? You'd say, the King. So you put a the when you're addressing someone by their title. And the ah ending means the. Hebrew puts the word the at the beginning of a word, but Aramaic puts it at the back end. And so when you see Aramaic words that end in ah, it's quite often a the.
Same in the beginning.
Right. Yes, Mark.
One more question. In Mark 11, Jesus has his triumphal entry, and then immediately after that, he clears the temple, rebuking what's going on there. Is that a third temple clearing, or is that kind of out of sequence?
No. There are two cleansings. The synoptics talk about his final cleansing of the temple, but the Gospel of John talks about his first cleansing of the temple.
So it's after his triumphal, his triumphant.
Oh, okay. Let's clarify one detail in Jesus' final week. Each night he went to Bethany, which is just over the summit of the Mount of Olives. So when we are looking at different accounts, it's easy to think that we're looking necessarily at the same trip between Bethany and Jerusalem in each of the accounts, but since each night he went to Bethany and each day he came back to Jerusalem, the apparent three-way transposition that occurs is one that is not an actual three-way transposition, although it appears to be.
So is the sequence in Mark 7:11 is his entry on Palm Monday, right?
Right.
And then after that is...
But the cursing of the fig tree, its placement ends up being placed differently because of the different days that are being looked at by different accounts. And it's been a while since I've gone through the details on that, but Diane, if you could, I'll make a slide up on the how to handle the timing on the cursing of the fig tree. That's ultimately the issue that comes in.
Okay. Yeah, I'm confused because subsequent to that entry, he clears the temple. In verses 15.
Right. I'm going to have to take a look at that one.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
So I just had Diane mark a note for me to deal with the sequencing on that. My dissertation dealt with the relationship between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and transpositions, that is, different sequences, were a major feature of what I had to deal with. So, but I'm a little rusty on this particular one.
That's great. Thank you.
John, I have a question.
Yes.
In Mark 5, the healing of the demon-possessed man, in verse 19, Jesus says, go home after you healed him. Go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. And then right after that, with the dead girl, he tells them, he gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them,
don't tell anybody.
So in one case, and he's been saying, as we've been reading, don't tell anyone, don't tell anyone. My time has not yet come. So are these two healings in the right, you know, one says yes and one says don't say.
Yeah, let's see. The issue here, okay, in Mark we have an issue that's called the messianic secret, that there's a lot of prominence given to Jesus telling people not to proclaim openly. Now if we back up a little bit in Mark, we find out why that is going on, in that let's see. Okay, we've got a reference in here that they're, see, we have in 3:20 that they couldn't, they were not able to even eat a meal, but we've got a reference in here about he couldn't enter into a town because
of their faith.
There were so many people that were just absolutely mobbing him. Going to Mark chapter 1, verse 40, he has healed the leper and told him to go show himself to the priest. But he didn't do that. What he did was to go and proclaim it openly, and that started people just mobbing him. What was supposed to have happened, the way the Messiah was supposed to be revealed, was the Messiah would do signs, leadership would see it, they would evaluate whether this person was a pretender or was actually the Messiah, and then they were to be the ones that persuaded the crowds. Instead, what's happening is we have demons proclaiming his name. We have all sorts of things that are making it so he's getting mobbed, and it's making it very difficult to do things. So that's the general situation. But now let's look at Mark 5, and we'll see something that is different about Mark 5 that allows Jesus to approach things differently. Mark 5, 1. Then they came to the other side of the sea. That would be the Sea of Galilee. The other side, all the way through the Gospels, always talks about the east side. They're on the east side. To the country of the Gadarenes. Now, he's in Gentile territory. Since he's in Gentile territory, the issue isn't going to be that they're going to have people saying, this is our Messiah.
Because they don't know.
Yeah, it's a different situation. It doesn't matter if Gentiles speak openly among Gentiles. But when you see him in Jewish areas, then he's having to deal with controlling the problem of the mobs.
Okay.
And so, notice when you get down to 5:20, and he departed and began to proclaim in Decapolis. Now, when we were in Israel, we were in Bethshan. That's the only city of the Decapolis that is on the west side of the Jordan River. And so the rest of the Decapolis was east of the Jordan, east of the Sea of Galilee, Gentile territory. So in 5:1 through 20, Jesus is outside of Israel proper. He's in an area where it would be a Jewish minority instead of a Jewish majority. And he can approach things differently under those circumstances.
So then he crosses over on 21 when Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side. So he's going back to the west side.
Yeah.
Where it's mostly Jewish.
Right.
And that's where he says, don't tell anyone.
Yep.
That makes sense.
So the geography ends up having quite an impact on that issue.
Yeah.
Why he has to tell the leaders and the leaders to proclaim it?
There were Old Testament passages, I don't remember addresses right now. Then
it's Isaiah, the bruised reed, isn't it?
I think you're right. That's which is
Isaiah 61 or 11.
Isaiah 42. He will not cry out or raise his voice, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break. smoking flax he will not quit until he has established justice. Right? That's 42, 1 through 4.
Yeah.
So he has to fulfill that prophecy.
Right. Yeah, he wasn't, the idea was not for him to be his own mouthpiece. And the leadership was very concerned because at this particular time there were a lot of people claiming to be the Messiah. And so I sometimes use the illustration that we tell kids, don't talk to strangers. Well, unless they're in a uniform, or, you know, you end up having to have some exceptions in order to make it so that their situation doesn't perpetuate. There ultimately have to be some people that they can trust. The fact that Deuteronomy 18 and other passages talked about there would be false people who would be making false claims made it so that they said, okay, well, we're supposed to stop all the people making false claims. Gee, everybody's making false claims. But if they were dealing with the Old Testament properly, they would have said, okay, clearly God is intending to send a Messiah. So how do we recognize him? Deuteronomy chapter 18 gave the criteria that there would be validating short-term prophecies. Now, the Messiah or other prophets could make long-term prophecies, but in order for them to be proven to be sent from God, they had to make short-term prophecies that happened exactly as they had predicted. And so my definition of signs in John's gospel is that they are short-term fulfilled prophecies. Each of those signs he gave hints, or on some occasions fairly direct indication that he was going to do something, and then he did it. Short-term fulfilled prophecy. That was how he validated himself as the Messiah. But the religious leaders were looking and saying, we've got all these false pretenders, so therefore everyone who's coming, it's our duty to undo them. Instead of saying, well, Deuteronomy 18 is God's criteria for us to determine who is the Messiah. So, okay, I guess we better take a look at Daniel. Daniel chapter 4.
You're a synoptic, though.
Yep.
How about a quick Leviticus question?
Okay.
Chapter 19. There's just a bunch of do not. And it always bugs me when he says, do not cut your body or tattoo for the dead. What does he mean by throwing in that for the dead? 19:28.
Exodus 19:28?
Leviticus.
Well, a lot of the pagan religions, they would start cutting themselves if they were praying and they didn't get answers. I mean, we see that with Elijah there on Mount Gilboa with the prophets of Baal. My suspicion is that these would be things that they would be doing to perhaps have communication with the dead or something along that line. That's what I suspect. But I get Diane, if you mark down for me to look at Leviticus 19:28, I'll See if there's anything I...
Well, it makes sense. There's so much in Leviticus and the rules, and people were partiers.
Blow
trumpets and take the day off.
The whole issue there for what was attractive to them about all the pagan religion was that sexual immorality was a major
really
part of
it. Get into that list.
All that, and so forth. So, I mean, you know, there was always the tendency to go to the gods of the Canaanites, the gods of the Egyptians, and even the gods of the Babylonians, because there was familiarity carried by Abraham from there and so forth. And so there were warnings that were about all sorts of things that they faced because of one group or another that they were coming into contact with. Okay, let's go to Daniel. I did not make a PowerPoint this week. It was a little hard to figure out what I could make a PowerPoint of on some of it, so I didn't really come up with good ideas on it, so that's the reason. But in looking at your notes, we've talked about the date stamps within the book of Daniel. That there are a number of verses within the book that give us the date of a particular passage. And so we're able to say that Daniel 1:1 is dated 605 BC. It's in the third year of Jehoiakim, who was king of Judah. Then Daniel 2:1 is the second event, 603 to 602 BC. Then you'll notice I have three lines in there that are not in bold. Those have not been there in previous sessions because they're not part of the date stamps. Daniel 5:31, we have a date stamp. 7:1, 8:1, 9:1, 10:1, and 11:1. You notice that the sequence of them, which is on the right-hand side of the page, they don't all go in chronological order. So that event number 5 is placed in Daniel 5, whereas events 3 and 4 are placed within Daniel 7 and 8. The question arises, why is it that Daniel does not arrange his book in chronological order? Well, that second chart where I have chiasm in the book of Daniel, or chiasm in the Aramaic section of Daniel, Daniel is written partly in Hebrew and partly in Aramaic. Daniel 2:4b through the end of chapter 7 is written in Aramaic, not in Hebrew. In this section, there are prophecies that are viewed. Daniel 2, Daniel 7. But those prophecies are described in a Gentile language, in Aramaic. And they view prophetic events from a Gentile standpoint. But when you look at the prophecies that are within Hebrew sections of the book of Daniel, those same events can be viewed, but they're being viewed from a Jewish perspective. So, let's look at the arrangement of Daniel 2 through 7. We have a chiasm, which means that it's like a sandwich. The word chiasm comes from the Greek letter, chi, which looks like an X. And what it's talking about is crisscrossing. That what you have, if you notice, Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar had a vision of prophetic history. And that was where he saw the great statue, the great image. But then in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel has a vision that's also looking at four kingdoms that are followed by the Messianic kingdom. They're like the pieces of bread in a sandwich. Chapter 2 corresponds to chapter 7. But now look at 3 and 6. We have the fiery furnace, which was punishment for worshiping the Lord. Daniel 6 corresponds to that. That's like having a layer of lettuce in this sandwich between the pieces of bread on each side of that sandwich. They correspond to each other. But then in the very middle, you have the humiliation of Nebuchadnezzar, the passage we're going to look at, where he's made like a beast. And then you have the humiliation of Belshazzar, where he dies. Yes?
Now, which are Aramaic and which are Hebrew?
Daniel 2, starting at verse 4b, all the way through chapter 7. So this chiasm covers the Aramaic section of the book.
It's all Aramaic.
Yes, Clay.
So that has to deal with the Gentiles.
Can you explain why they were in chiasm?
Okay, sure. Okay, we were talking about this on our way home last week. We have outline procedures, you know, that we're familiar with. You know, you make an outline, and we're taught in elementary school how to do an outline. But chiasm was an easy way for them to mentally outline. That if you go through and you say, well, I've got my A, my B, my C, my D. Then I've got the point that corresponds to D,
D1.
The one that corresponds to C, the one that corresponds to B, and the one that corresponds to A. Write another note, please. Tell me to bring Alan Ross's chiasm in Genesis. So there'll be something interesting I'll pass out next week. Not next Thursday, 2 weeks from now. We're not meeting next Thursday because the Andersons will be out of town.
So what's the center point for the chiasm here?
Well, when you have an even number, then it's the pair that are at the center.
But so this one doesn't have a center point.
Right.
Okay.
Some chiasms have even numbers and some have odd, and that
Pastor
changes.
Pastor Jones talked about chiasm and his center piece, and he makes stuff, I don't know.
Isn't it this pairs?
Yes, the pair.
If you have seven of them,
yeah,
then the middle one's the
so
main
this one
point.
Doesn't matter.
But when you have a pair, then the pair are the center.
The center.
Okay. Yes.
Were there any other languages within the book other than Aramaic?
No. The two books of the Old Testament that have lengthy sections in Aramaic are Daniel and Ezra. Here and there, even in Genesis, you run into short stretches that are Aramaic. Aramaic is not greatly different than Hebrew, but there are interesting differences.
Didn't Jesus speak Aramaic?
Yes, but I believe he also read Hebrew, and I believe that John read and wrote in Hebrew as well. But the word for gold in Hebrew is zahav. And the word in Aramaic is dehav.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a D rather than a Z that starts it. Aramaic did not like the sound SH. They did not like sh. So we're going to find out about that next week. Because it has an important thing, because what they did was they changed certain things so that In Psalm 22, you run into a place called Bashan or Bashan. But in the New Testament, it has an Aramaic name, Botanea. So the Golan Heights were known as Bashan, and then they became Bataneia. So there end up being changes like that, and instead of attaching the word the at the beginning of the word, they're put at the end of the word, and you know, just lots of things, and you have to get used to just things looking different, being just a little weird. Yes?
Those other places where there's some Aramaic in it, is it similar to like in Daniel where there's a purpose for it? Like,
well, sure.
You're saying that this represents the, you know, what happens to the Gentiles more? And
what happens is that we have decrees that are written by a foreign king. And those decrees are recorded in Aramaic, which was the language that it was written in. But because of the captivities, Israel, the Israelis, at the time of the conquest, or when, let's see, during the Assyrian siege that happened there in Kings, the Assyrians would move from speaking in Aramaic as they normally did to speaking by the wall and making their threats in Hebrew. And so the Judean leaders were saying, could you please talk in Aramaic so that all the people wouldn't understand you? And they said, no, we want them to understand what we're saying. But then, when you read the book of Ezra, the people had been under foreign domination long enough that Aramaic was more comfortable for them. So when Ezra read the law, which happens in Ezra chapter 8, he was having to give the sense of it in Aramaic to the people because their Hebrew wasn't so good anymore. So it's an interesting thing that happens. But, okay, so we've talked about the chiasm. We've talked about the fact that we have a non-chronological sequence. Let me point something else out. You'll notice that I added some things that are not in bold. The reason that they're added is because they concern the dates for Daniel chapter 4. But they are not date stamps. In other words, you can't go to a verse that says, this verse is describing this date. We have to go to history in order to figure out this chronology. We know that the year of the conquest by Nebuchadnezzar, where he finally did in Jerusalem entirely, was 586 BC. Daniel chapter 4 is introducing an interesting period of time in Nebuchadnezzar's life where the historical records go silent. We have a period of time where nothing is said. It's just silent. And then he comes back for a little while and then he dies in 562. So Daniel chapter 4 would be in that period of 570 BC to 563 BC. And so we don't have a date stamp. It's only because of meshing this with what we know about Babylonian history that we're able to say when Daniel chapter 4 occurs. Okay. So with that as background, now let's look at the passage. You remember that Nebuchadnezzar, after he heard the repetition of his vision and the interpretation by Daniel, remember he had the vision of the image that had the head of gold, the upper torso of silver, the lower torso of bronze, and then the iron legs and the iron amalgam with clay for the toes and feet. Daniel explained that that was sequence of prophetic history, and that Nebuchadnezzar was represented by the head of gold, but he was going to be replaced by a nation that was inferior to his, and that would be Media Persia, which would be replaced by something inferior to them, Greece, then replaced by Rome. But then finally there would be a stone that would smash the feet, topple the entire edifice, and that stone would turn into a mountain that would fill the whole earth. And that stone, by the way, was uncut by hand. Well, Nebuchadnezzar got a big head, shall we say. And so what he did was he built a 90-foot statue. Talked about that last week. And proclamation was made that everyone needed to bow to it, and Daniel's three companions did not. They were thrown into the fiery furnace, but lo and behold, Nebuchadnezzar is there in his lounge chair looking on, and he looks and he says, wow, there's someone else walking in there, and they're all free. So they let them out, and he makes proclamations about that one that he saw, I believe, that was a pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. Interestingly, the Judeans were delivered. The only thing that burned on them was their ropes that tied them. They didn't even have the smell of smoke, and they suffered no ill effects. Nebuchadnezzar made a proclamation concerning Daniel's God. Now, if, you know, we look at this, and the tendency is to think, well, Nebuchadnezzar became a believer. What I would suggest instead is he had a whole bunch of gods, and now he's saying, you know, that Hebrew God can be added into this whole system. So he hasn't really learned his lesson. And so what we're going to have him do is make a proclamation here saying, Daniel's got a pretty good God here. And he does that probably around 570 BC. So in verses 1 through 3 of chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar made a proclamation about the high God. That would be Daniel's high God. So Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. How great are his signs, and how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. He's picking up on what was said about the stone that was uncut by hand that would destroy all preceding kingdoms. There would be no residue from them in the everlasting kingdom that God will establish. It will be a literal kingdom on planet Earth. And Nebuchadnezzar seems to have just added these truths to his whole system. Now, I found an interesting thing when I teach in seminary. You have students who will say, you know, this is great stuff. I'm learning things, and they're learning and learning and learning and learning and learning. And then there reaches the point where some big thing in their own personal system comes at odds with the new material. And the question is, what do we do then? Do we say, I'm sticking with the old, and I'm trashing the new? Or do we say, it's time to look closely and figure out which one is right? And I've seen students that have gone both ways. That, you know, my area of specialization is to teach New Testament Greek, and sometimes some bubbles get popped. And the question becomes, what do you do at that point? I don't expect anybody to say, well, John said it, so therefore it's right. And I hope they don't say, well, John said it, so therefore it's wrong. I hope that what they do instead is to say, I'm going to bury my nose in the text and I'm going to figure out what the right answer is. Nebuchadnezzar, I don't think he ever allowed what he learned from Daniel to come into conflict with what he already believed. He just said, okay, I'll add this. Not, you know, what Daniel is saying contradicts my whole system. So he makes wonderful statements when he's speaking from the truth he's learned. But when he speaks from his background, it's an entirely different story. So we look at what his proclamation is in verses 1 through 3, and we say, it looks very good. But I think God is dealing with him in verses 4 through 7. He has his second dream. And only Daniel could interpret Nebuchadnezzar's second dream. Now, I think he knew this already in advance, that, okay, Daniel's going to be able to answer this. He goes ahead and asks his advisors what it means. But I think he knew that Daniel was going to be the one that could interpret. Verse 4, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house, flourishing in my palace. He seems to have only lived a short period of time in the wonderful palace in the great city that he built, and Steve's book is circulating, so you can see some of what the glories of Babylon looked like. And he's at rest in his house. He's flourishing in his palace. Verse 5. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts on my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore I issued a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers came in, and I told them the dream, but they did not make known to me its interpretation. Verse 8, but at last Daniel came before me. His name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. In him is the spirit of the holy God, and I told him the dream before him, so forth. Okay, so I read into the next passage just to give a little bit of an indication. Remember, at the end of chapter 1, we saw that Daniel, when he was examined at the end of his 3-year training period, was 10 times greater than all the magicians, all the advisors. We worked out the sequencing on that. Remember that I argued that chapter 2 probably had occurred prior to the end of the 3-year training program. That resolves a question of, well, if Daniel is so far superior to everyone, why is it that Nebuchadnezzar didn't go to him first? It's because, in my opinion, Nebuchadnezzar didn't yet know that Daniel was 10 times better than all of his advisors. I believe that chapter 2 occurred near the end of that 3-year training period. It was at that time that Nebuchadnezzar found out that, okay, Daniel is the one who can tell me what my vision was as well as what it means, not because Daniel is so great, but because his God has revealed this to him. So I don't think that Nebuchadnezzar is going to all of his advisors at this point saying, one of them ought to be able to answer. I think he's giving another trial run to see, okay, I know that I've got in my back pocket that Daniel is going to be able to give me the interpretation. But notice, although he's had great success, he's built his city, he's looking out over it, probably from the flat top roof of his house, his palace, and he's saying, wow, look at all this that I have done. He's got a big head again. And then he has this dream. And this dream shakes him to the core. None of his magicians, none of his advisors were able to give an answer. But then, in verse 8, he calls for Daniel. So in verses 8 and 9, Daniel called his men, and then he called Daniel. But Daniel, overall, in this section, verses 8 through 18, Daniel interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And so here we're going to see him calling Daniel. But at last, Daniel came before me. His name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. Notice he hasn't given up his polytheism, has he? They had renamed all these hostages of the royal family names that honored the Babylonian gods. And Nebuchadnezzar still is speaking, and he's claiming his Babylonian gods as his god. He's claiming Marduk. In him is the spirit of the holy God. So he's saying, okay, I've got my God. Daniel has his God. Both of them exist. Both of them are true. And I told the dream before him, saying, Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know the spirit of the holy God is in you, and that no secret troubles you, explain to me the visions of my dream that I have seen, and its interpretation. Now this time is different than the first dream. With the first dream, Nebuchadnezzar said, I'm not going to tell you what the dream was. You need to tell me it and the interpretation. But what we have in verses 10 through 12 is he tells the first part of it, the good part, the part where there's the great tree. Nebuchadnezzar now tells Daniel the first part of his dream, the great tree, verses 10 through 12. These were the visions of my head while on my bed. I was looking, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong. Its height reached to the heavens, and it could be seen to the ends of all the earth or all the land. Its leaves were lovely, its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, the birds of the heavens dwelt in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. He's saying, this looks like prosperity. You could almost imagine him putting this out as a campaign ad. We're going to be inundated with campaign ads as we're approaching primary season. He's saying, wow, you know, this was just absolutely wonderful. Looks like the economy here in Babylon is rosy, the future is great, and, you know, this must be talking about how good a how good an emperor I am. So, in verses 13 through 17, Nebuchadnezzar now tells the second part of his dream, the watcher's words. This watcher would be an angelic being, a high angel. I saw in the visions of my head while on my bed, and there was a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, chop down the tree and cut off its branches. Strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts get out from under it, and the birds from its branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump and the roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field. Let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man. Let him be given the heart of a beast, and let seven times pass over him. This decision is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets it over the lowest of men. Whoa, this is getting scary. He's saying, that great tree that looks like everything prosperous, that he thought was representing his kingdom, and I guess we'll find out it is, it gets chopped down and its branches all get cut. Strip all of its leaves off it. Scatter all the beasts. Scatter all the birds. But leave that stump and the roots. But notice the transformation. That stump transforms into a man. In the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven. Let him graze with the beasts. On the grass of the earth, let his heart be changed from that of a man. Let him be given the heart of a beast. And this is going to go on for seven times. So Nebuchadnezzar is really getting shaken by this. I mean, this dream started out just wonderful. This wouldn't be the deer of the dawn. This would be the deer of the sunset. I mean, this is going the opposite direction. Things are getting really, really bad. He got really scared. So in verse 18, he said, okay, Daniel, it's up to you and your God. You need to interpret this for me. I'm confident God will give you the interpretation. So in verse 18, this dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, declare its interpretation. Since all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the Spirit of the Holy God is in you. So as we've indicated, Nebuchadnezzar believes that there's something about the God of Daniel, but he hasn't shed his own gods. So he has confidence that Daniel will be able to do what none of his wise men could do, to give the interpretation. Verses 19 through 27 are where Daniel interprets Nebuchadnezzar's second dream. In verse 19, Daniel is perplexed, and Nebuchadnezzar encourages him regardless, but Daniel has a big concern. Verse 19, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him. The king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream concern those who hate you, and its interpretation concern your enemies. You know, if you give bad news to the king, he might shoot the messenger. And so Daniel is there saying, uh-oh, this doesn't look good. What kind of a response am I going to get here when he hears how bad the bad news is? So he's There, can you imagine how many prayers he shot up right then? Saying, Lord, am I a dead man walking? I mean, this doesn't look good for me either. So he's pondering what to say. I mean, bad news to the king was not something that Daniel really wanted to do here. But I think Nebuchadnezzar is saying, okay, I guess I'm going to have to take my medicine. This is a scary dream. And Daniel isn't the one that gave it to me. It came from his God. So, Daniel, I need to know here. Now, I remember a time Diane and I got married back in 1978, and I had an opportunity to go and preach a church that was about 500 miles from where we were for a couple of Sundays and midweek service, and also able to visit some family members. So we went down to visit, and my mother was getting the mail for us, and I had a business. And my mother said, you got a letter from the IRS. And I said, Mom, you've got to open it and tell me what it is, because I won't be able to sleep knowing that the letter came. And they said, on all of your attachments, you forgot to sign your name one time. So we're sending that back to you for you to sign that page. If you do that again, we'll fine you so much money. I was fine. So, but if I hadn't known what the bad news was, it really wasn't all that bad, but it's like, an IRS letter would not have allowed me to sleep. Nebuchadnezzar is saying here, Daniel, I know it's bad news, but I'm not sleeping. You got to tell me what it is. And so Daniel said, I certainly hope that this dream isn't about you. But Daniel knew that it was. So he said, my Lord, may the dream concern those who hate you, and its interpretation concern your enemies. He knows this is bad news. So at that point, verses 20 through 22, he gives the interpretation of the good part, the great tree. The tree that you saw, which grew and became strong, whose height reached to the heavens and which could be seen by all the earth, whose leaves were lovely and its fruit abundant, in which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and in whose branches the birds of the heaven had their home. It is you, O King, who have grown and become strong. For your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. He's saying, you are all-powerful from the standpoint of earth. So that's the good part. Nebuchadnezzar, that's you. That's all your glory. But then comes the bad part. Verses 23 to 27, the interpretation of the watcher's words. And inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king. And this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. They shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times will pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. And inasmuch as they gave the command to leave the stump and the roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you after you come to know that heaven rules. By the way, this is the only place in the Old Testament where heaven is used to stand for God. Therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity. Notice he's not promising eternal life, he's promising an extension of life. So, Nebuchadnezzar went from having it all to being like a beast. There are people that have been documented that have had symptoms similar to this. He lost his mind, shall we say. But it wasn't a permanent loss. He was able to come back because he figured out things about God, things that he hadn't understood. I don't know that he ever became a believer, but that possibility does exist. But the dream in its fulfillment is that Nebuchadnezzar was humiliated. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and the honor of my majesty?" Whoops. That triggered it all. While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven. "King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times, that is 7 years, shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses." You know, that was the lesson that he was supposed to learn about the image that he dreamed about in chapter 2. The head of gold was going to get replaced by the upper torso of bronze, of silver, and the lower torso of bronze would replace it. And then finally, Rome would replace it. God is sovereign over history. Dr. Walvoord surmises that Daniel, because of his high position, might even have been the caretaker for the administration. That's a possibility. One thing he suggests that might be supporting evidence for it, although there could be other explanations, is normally when there was any weakness shown by a leader, that leader was overthrown. But Nebuchadnezzar came out of the period of silence, and where it actually there's are statements about the inactivity of Nebuchadnezzar. And despite that weakness, despite what's going on here, he didn't get toppled, he didn't get killed. And that's not the normal pattern that one would see in a country like this. And the question becomes, Nebuchadnezzar had placed Daniel in such a high position. Is it possible that that's the explanation? I'm not going to be dogmatic because I have no way of knowing. We don't have the evidence to support an answer for what happened because we just don't have very much that's known about that period of time, except it's basically a silent period of time. Yes?
Was he not placed second underneath?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's it's a realistic possibility, and it makes the most sense of things, but I'm not going to state it dogmatically because there's just no way to document it. So there's a restoration, and that was promised in the vision as well. So we have his restoration in verses 34 to 37. At the end of the time, the end of the 7 years, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and my splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride he is able to put down. Notice how what he says at the end corresponds to his proclamation at the beginning of the chapter, verses 1 through 3. Now, that's a chiasm, by the way, that he starts and he ends on a very similar note. But my suspicion is at this point he knows far more about the truth of this. I don't know if he became a believer, but he certainly, as time goes on, seems to get closer and closer to the truth, and I wouldn't rule out the possibility that he died a believer. But isn't this giving warnings that are similar to that which James gives? Where you have people who say, in the book of James, let's go to such and such a town, buy and sell, make a profit, do this and that. But he says, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills. Pride goes before a fall. And what we have here is the center, or half of the center, of the chiasm in the Aramaic section. We have the humiliation of Nebuchadnezzar, and we're going to see the humiliation of Belshazzar in chapter 5. That's the handwriting on the wall passage, and we'll consider that in 2 weeks. We're not meeting next week.